Welcome to Wabanaki Windows. I'm your host, Donna Loring. This series focuses on hidden elements that have influenced Wabanaki history from the invasion of our shores in the 18th century to the land claims and beyond. Today, we continue our discussion about the hidden element of blood quantum and the influence it has played in the development of tribal communities, membership numbers, and our very identities. This is a highly controversial subject. We realize there are no easy answers. My guests today are Professors Harold Prince, Professor of Anthropology Emeritus at Kansas State University, Professor Darren Ranko, a member of the Penobscot Nation, and Professor of Anthropology and Chair of Native American Studies at the University of Maine. Our special guest today is Morgan Talte. He's a member of the Penobscot Nation and an award-winning author of Night of the Living Res and his latest book, Fire Exit. Morgan is currently teaching creative writing at the University of Maine. Welcome to the show. Okay, so what do you all feel is the most important aspect of blood quantum to the tribal communities? Darren.
The thing that I think is even like, if we were to change from, say, you know, our current blood quantum arrangement to a more lineal descent, like you're, you know, if your whatever relative was, if your relative was on the rolls, you know, some, you know, at some point in time, and then everyone descended from them, you know, would be considered a citizen of the nation, the tribe. You know, I think it is, there is this fear of change, right? Which is sort of normal, normal for communities to be like, oh, we don't want, you know, all these people, and the fear of like diminishing resources. You know, there's all sorts of logics around it, which are meaningful to people, you know, very, you can't easily dismiss those things. That's why I think, you know, gradual shifts are probably more realistic in a lot of these things sometimes. But I think, you know, I think it is about kinship, why people still use it, because it fills in around what a notion of kinship would be. I think, you know, I think, Donna, you know, your question before we even started recording is sort of like, who are we? You know, I think people can tangibly think about who we are as our kin, you know, but I think the way that we understand and even identify kin, if we're thinking of it as biogenetic substance, which is a very non-indigenous way, right? The blood itself, right, isn't primarily like how we, our clan systems were not built around, you know, biogenetic substance, but roles and responsibilities and kin relations. But kin relations and biogenetic kin are not, they don't map on to the same thing, right? There is not merely, it's about like who you're sharing DNA with. It's share your, who you're sharing space with, who you're sharing values with, who you're sharing, you know, so all of those things kind of make it complicated. So I think it's really like, you know, if we're willing to, and I think this is why Kim Tallbear's work is so important, because she more than other people have really been able to say like, that idea that DNA is like what we is what our identity is as Indigenous people is not correct, right? She's very clear in communicating that it is not like you have 1% of a DNA of something, therefore you're that thing. If our identities mean anything as Indigenous people and as nations, it is what we share beyond, you know, as kin is not biogenetic substance. Kin is a set of relationships and roles and responsibilities. So I think you know, what's compelling about blood quantum is that it fills in for kin. What is damning about it is that we're confusing it with things like DNA, the mere biogenetic substance.
The question was, in your view, in your personal view, what is the most important, I guess you might say, cause and effect, maybe let's say effect of blood quantum? on tribal communities. And I think you kind of answered that, Darren, but
Yeah, I mean, I think this downside is, when we talk about percentages and we talk about those things, right? That logic is a diminishing return logic, right? So I think that's why, even the, if you say you're 25% something or 50% something or so, like that doesn't get to the heart of what being a citizen, regardless of our blood quantum, like what a being citizen, being part of a community, a polity, right, is about is we reject that on its face on some level, I think, in civil society broadly, that we don't want the quarter bloods to be only considered a quarter a part of the community and the half bloods to be, say, like we don't, although but that logic is ever remains if we continue with the blood quantum, the quantum pieces of it. It always will resort to that kind of logic.
How do you feel, and from your perspective, your personal perspective, what do you think is the most important effect of blood quantum in the tribal communities? You want to think about that? I'll ask Carol if you want to think about that.
Yeah. Well, Morgan is thinking, I don't have to think very long because I'm not a Penobscot. I'm not an Indigenous person. So for me, it's in a way that question doesn't pertain. If I understood Darren well, that in a way it is a different type of phrasing of essentially the same issue, namely belonging or not belonging. And how do you measure that? And I think we have a problem with both the term quantum, as Darren just was emphasizing, as well as the term blood. Once you begin to look at kinship, as Darren also was saying, it's rights and obligations to the community. So a member has kinship obligations and has kinship rights, and they're articulated in what we call kin terms. So an uncle, a nephew, a cousin, father, mother, grandfather. In some cultures, you have many people who are identified as a mother and as a father. That's not an exclusive term. What we would consider a paternal uncle, for example, might be a father in some cultures, or a maternal aunt may also be a mother. Depends on it. And so that defines the relationship between that person who is identified as a mother or as a child, daughter or son. That's all embedded in that terminology. And what you see now globally, that with the inroads of capitalism and colonialism, it is these kinship structures have been destroyed to make way for capitalism, where everybody is thrown back on individuality. So once you are cut from the kinship connection, the kinship community of shared resources and resource allocation, that means that the labor market can then dispose and even predispose of individuals who are no longer in that web of relationships because they have to move, let's say, from Maine for a job to Florida, for example. And then as a result, can't participate in the collective fishing, for example. I just mentioned that as an example. So the point about blood and blood quantum, once you demystify that concept that's so burdened by colonialism, but once you demystify it and no longer are captured by that term and begin to think about what it means, it sets a certain kind of standard or a baseline from which you begin to calculate who is and who is not entitled to membership. And so it's a baseline that, as we all know, it's a moving baseline because many Native communities have shifted it from the baseline, like the Passamaquoddy, I believe, did. From the 1870 census, anyone who's listed on that census is considered to be full blood, although in reality, it may be a person who has three-quarter ancestry who's French. So, but that becomes a baseline as if that person is 100%, and then you begin to calculate down the list to whether it's 50% or whatever. And the final thing before Morgan may have had time to collect his thought. I was thinking also about the issue of sovereignty, and you see that in Europe, for example, where you have declining birth rates in the indigenous populations of places like Italy, very sharp, but also the Netherlands, Germany, Portugal, is where the right of return, so to speak, has been emphasized, whereby people can get a visa based on demonstration whether they had a parent who was a national but emigrated to Australia or the United States, for example, that that child can make go to Luxembourg or whatever the country is, offer evidence of the fact that he or she has a, in the case of Luxembourg, a grandparent, regardless of gender, was a had citizenship in Luxembourg. And then the Luxembourg government has certain kind of conditions by which that person can then get Luxembourg citizenship with all the rights that may come with it. And I don't know exactly about the obligations. So some countries set that baseline to a parent. Some countries set it at a grandparent. And another one say it's a great-grandparent. And so these are different components. And then the final comment is, again, about sovereignty, because in this case, it's Luxembourg that determines, but the people who get Luxembourg citizenship also get European citizenship, and as a result, free visa travel all across the globe for certainly for about 120, 150 countries. So then the final comment is that some countries use the so-called golden visa rule. In other words, if you donate or invest a minimum of $250,000 or $300,000, you can get a visa from that country, including passport, but it comes with the obligation to invest. So in other words, that whole domain that gets opened up as a result of the question about the Indian card gets back to sovereignty, who makes these rules, who applies the rules, and what is the quid pro quo? Anyway, I leave now to Morgan.
So what I'm taking from that, Harold, is that we should turn Indian country into a country club. No, I'm just kidding. It sounded funny thinking about that for a moment. But I think it's so hard for me to answer the question because I go in either one or two directions. It's following Harold's kind of, you know, this legal Western kind of like framework that we have to navigate and work within. And I think there's definitely benefits associated with it, right? But those benefits, unfortunately, come from the foundation of something that's meant, in my view, to limit us, you know? So it's like, here it's like credit cards in a way. It's like, here's some credit cards, you get some, you know, perks, but really, you know, a lot of people won't know how to use them. And then they end up in debt, you know, and it's like this vicious cycle. But then the other part of me is like to sort of, I don't know. I can't help equate identity with a general sense of just human emotion, you know, this like, because for me, you know, just as a writer, that's the thing that I, with fiction anyways, is, you know, is like really driving and making somebody feel, because like if that's the, for me, that's the unifying factor amongst all of us, unless of course, you know, people are limited by, you know, some sort of you know, mental incapacity, you know, where they're disabled and they don't have the ability to feel a certain way or express it, or you know, we can't see it. But for the general population, emotion, which is a cultural thing in and of itself, is like, we all know what sadness is. We all know what grief is. We all know what happiness is, joy is. And it's like, what if we build, as a writer, if you build a story on that, and story here we can use synonymously with society, it's like, you know, that's when we get real genuine empathy. And I think, not to say that negates any badness or, you know, evil in the world, but it's like, yeah, identity for me has always been tied to emotion, right? And it's like, I don't know, it's like if you feel that you've experienced, right, what it's like, not to say that you can't fully experience the other or embody it, but you have certain instances where people have grown up in communities, right? If we think about indigenous communities with non-natives living on the reservation and taking in the culture, right, and all of that, it's like they've experienced it in the same way we have, who are on the census, except for they're not on the census and they've had that negative association, right, and experiences. But I think it's kind of, I just, yeah, I'm not, okay, I don't know, I'm thinking it's like the most important effect of blood quantum has, interestingly enough, I think created a lot of conversations about how not just Indigenous people can think about what it means to live, but I think other nations and other societies, right? It's not an inclusive tribal conversation, but it's one I think that can be a broader one, you know, for people just in general. You know, what does it mean to belong to a place? What does it mean to have that place's boundaries, whether they're physically seen or invisible, you know, be permeable, right? And allow others, you know, to pass in and out, right? With respect and everything that comes along with that. I don't know. Now I'm starting to like build a mental map of some fictional, you know, utopia world or something. But yeah, I think that perhaps might be the most important thing that I think that's come out of blood quantum is the idea that it's not just an Indigenous thing we can use to talk about, but it's a global thing, right? You know, it could be related to globalism and expansion and all of that. You know, what, sort of rambling here, but I mean, that seems to be my takeaway from it, is it's like a quadruple edged times 10 sword. I'm not sure if there's a word for it, you know.
No, I kind of agree. You know, Harold kind of touched on something. When you were talking, Harold, you said something about, and I equated it with othering, which is what this blood quantum does to tribes. It's, if you're not one of us, then you're one of them. And if you're one of them, you can't be one of us. So it's sort of like used to divide us, I think. And what I liked about what you were saying in the past shows, Morgan, was your creativity on how to use that othering tool as a tool maybe to create something different, like a larger tribal community or a bigger vision, rather than just chopping each other up with it. So anyway, that's what I kind of gathered from our past few minutes of conversation. Darren, what do you think?
Yeah, no, I mean, I like what you all have said, and it's added, you know, more specificity to like the implications of blood quantum. I think it's also we feel caught in it, and I often wonder, like, you know, sort of the things around the grass is greener, you know, like, oh, if we just went to this, then sort of our problems of like not shaming or telling other Indigenous people they're lesser than, you know, like, I don't know if all that goes away. You know what I'm saying? I feel like, you know, I know nations where they have lineal descent, they still have a lot of the same kind of, you know, negative dysfunctions over us all dealing with the traumas of colonialism and being cut off from our communities and cultures and harms therein. I do think blood quantum can exacerbate those issues for sure. But I think, you know, the ultimate tension of being colonized and not having control over our identities and our communities means that blood quantum is just another part of that puzzle. It's not all of the puzzle. It's not all of the causes of the harms. You know, so I think, you know, I guess I'm just really careful to be like, I don't, you know, when I think about, you know, and also when I see, when I read about it in Morgan and other people's work and more in the creative space, like, you just, you know, your heart aches, right? When you see the machinations around what Blood Quantum does to us, right? But that what it does to us is fueled by a lot of other things, a lot of other structures of dislocation and harm and extraction. And, you know, I think, so I think, you know, it still poses the same question of like, who are we? You know, I think us reckoning with that. You know, I teach a class, like, what is it? You know, I think being colonized, it's like one framing that I teach in one of my classes is like, if you, you know, if you're being cut off from the memories of your ancestors, you know, like, what does that mean in the legacy of colonization? Or, you know, how do we, you know, reckon with all of the things, the harms and the takings and historic traumas, right? You know, how do we move through that to construct, you know, a wholeness of our identities, right? Of our well-being. And so I think that that's just what it makes me think of, like, because I think, you know, it's, I don't see like, you know, if we were to just like solve this at Penobscot to be like, okay, now it's lineal descent, like all of the other problems and weird, you know, things around jealousies and, you know, more Indian than not, you know, like that doesn't go away right overnight either. Right. So I think it's just, I'm just trying to be realistic about Blood Quantum as an artifact of that. I think it, if we were to do make an action in regard to healing around what Blood Quantum has done, I do think though that would open up potentials for other things. You know, I think there have been moves within our nation and our community to, you know, think about other ways of identity, the ways of like, you know, reinvigorating our clan identities, for example. That's been proposed, you know, in the last 50 years at different times in different kind of ways. You know, I think all of those things would be moves towards healing if done the right way, but then they could also, I think people are uncertain, right? So they feel also like threats, right? To a status quo that we know. And then what is this unknown that I just kind of return to that because it's sort of like our politics, like, you know, tribal politics is like a lot of other politics. It's like how we, to the extent that we trust our leadership, to the extent that change would be a positive thing and not some sort of like machination or will to power. You know, I think we all, for good reasons, don't trust it entirely. And just sort of like, how do we have a community, really a truly community oriented forum around it? I think that would be the, I think that's a huge challenge. And I'd love to see those discussions. So.
Yeah, Morgan?
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, I agree with Darren. I think it's like, at times it can be over, at least I can definitely oversimplify. Everybody can oversimplify, you know, a complex issue. And, you know, it's like, that's why I'm so always so hesitant to answer questions, because I'm like, well, you know, if I think about it in this way, or if I think about it from this perspective, if I look at it in this way, it's like, there's, it's like a, one of those things that like the, at like a fair where like the maze of mirrors type thing, where you go in and it's like you see your reflection, and it's like you don't really know how to, you're trying to find your way out of the same thing, you know, which is seeing yourself, which in this case would just be Blood Quantum and solution, trying to get out. But no, I just keep, yeah, I don't know, now I'm like, I revert back. I think we need to, you know, I think there always needs to be that oversimplification in juxtaposition and sort of in, not in our argument, but in conversation with like the complex, right? And thinking about all the other stories, I'll call them stories, but really just narratives from every discourse community, be it you know, Western structural ones like anthropology, you know, and Native American studies, whatever that is, right? You know, if it's been built on a foundation of Western thought, you know, tribal, specific tribal ideology, which has me thinking too a little bit about, I wonder what our language, you know, looking back at it and really studying it, not to learn it, but I mean, to learn it, I think we should say, right? But to think about what the language, what ideologically is embedded in the language that we've lost the ability to use as a way of thinking, right? You know, othering is a very Western idea, othering people, but, you know, we think of the Sioux dialect and the word ni, which means both the self and place, depending on the context. You know, what in our language can teach us some things or remind us, right, about how we used to think. And then another thing I have, I'm kind of going on a spiel here, but like, I think baby steps is the big thing, is like baby, baby, baby steps. And I know we have the Youth Tribal Council still in place, right? And it's like, I had talked about this with, I think, Wabanaki Public Health about, you know, what if it was, you know, put into written, you know, like law or policy or something, where it's like somebody from the tribal youth council doesn't get to just go to council and the decision they're going to make, but actually be able to be like, no, this isn't good for us. You know what I mean? In sort of this reversed way, you know, we've all often looked to elders for answers, and it's like, how might we look at the youth who are going to be here and who are seeing things that in a rapidly changing world with, you know, literature, the accessibility of it, what they're seeing, what they're feeling. It's like, I wonder what type of power should be invested in them, you know, to help guide decisions, you know, actual decisions, you know, not wait until you're 18 to vote, but ask a 3-year-old, what do you think? No, I'm just kidding. But, you know, kids are brilliant, you know, they are, they have that creativity, right, that we all lose at some point, and except for the very few and rare people who get to keep it. But yeah, I don't know, that's my rant.
Donna, I had a question for you, like, just getting back to like, disrupting the flow, maybe that'll keep our listeners really engaged. Put a pause on Harold for a sec. But I really do have this question, because it strikes me when I talk to people, I do think that 1980 pre and post settlement act, in terms of the, when people talk about the structure and feeling of the community, right? Like that weighs heavily on, I think, my generation and older's time. I mean, as you know, I didn't grow up on Indian Island. So I'm more of a witness to it than an experiencer of it, but I definitely witnessed this as well, which is to say, the feel or vibe of the community before 1980, or even like early 80s, we'll say, and the vibe before then, as a kind of, yeah, I don't even know. I've heard other people from other tribal communities in our state say that Indian Island was a really supportive and community oriented place pre 1980, you know, like there was this real supportive and community oriented vibe, and that to a lot of people is sort of what it meant to feel like being in community, being in a tribal community, and being relying on one another, having deep ties and kinship with different families across the community, and then this sort of feeling of like, that sort of something fundamental broke in the years following the settlement, and sort of where, you know, what does it mean now to be of that community, of the nation? And I guess I just wanted you to reflect on that as a part of this puzzle around blood quantum, Donna, because it feels like those are, the way we talk about it, feel like we intertwine those things as well.
Sure. So growing up, I was in the minority, as I usually am, because my grandmother was white, Anglo-Saxon Protestant in a Catholic community. Okay. So in the, I'm going to say 50s, 60s, the 60s, maybe the 70s, there were families that were really close, of course, because of their religious beliefs. Some of them sent their kids to the island school to be taught by the nuns. My grandmother, of course, would never allow that. But neither would Pauline Shea, the Poulahs and some of the others. So there was healthy, debate or whatever. And so it wasn't all heavenly.
No, and
I know. So
I was trying to portray it like, again,
so
simplifying.
I'm just been there, done that, lived that. I know what these guys were like. The church, it meant a great deal to those families. The Catholic Church did. The families on the other side, who were not Catholic, who I'm going to say probably saw a great deal more of the world than the Catholic members of the church on the island. So, people like Lucy, they knew what it would power what power was to vote and that sort of thing. So they were sort of pushing those political issues. But I'll tell you that regardless of back then, regardless of what side of the issues you were on, and no matter how angry you became or your families became with each other, when a member of your family passed, everybody, both sides of that community, everybody would come by and give their condolences. They drop off food. They do whatever they could, regardless. And that's the piece I think that's missing from our community today. And I don't know if you can put it at the land claims. I think it's probably a gradual change of things. I don't think just one incident or just one happening did that.
You know how people's memories work, though. That tends to be the single event that kind of is pinpointed, and when people
It's
think,
nice to label one thing. It's
yeah,
just kind of
of
like
course.
what the majority culture does is they label something and we'll just put it on the shelf and no, there's more to it than that.
Well, I just think in terms of the struggle to define who we are vis-a-vis blood quantum or anything else, like, that discussion just weighs heavily in our community. I think again, basically for the over 50 crowd, or that could actually remember into the 70s or whatever, even as little kids, right? And then people younger generations who, Morgan included, like hearing the stories of that before time, which in shaping their kind of connection to community and what it means as well. Again, that weighs heavily, sort of just on who we are and what does it mean to be of our nation. And just the per capita checks came out, and just looking at the the back and forth, which is very funny, and people are, it hasn't turned as nasty as other things on Facebook can, but it's kind of a funny discussion of like, oh, now I'm, waiting for the per cap, that amount of money, and just da 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 da. And having people play with that in a way is part of the community experience. But I don't think people are like, oh, we're Penobscot because of that. But I think the idea of like, what is our collective, sort of thinking about the collective identity vis-a-vis these little things that kind of appear as we talk about them, as we, identify who we are. That's all.
Harold?
Yeah, I was thinking about the concept that some of your audience may not know, but it's imperialist nostalgia. And in this case, I thought that what you are talking now about is a variation of that, namely, you could call it indigeneity nostalgia. Namely, imperialist nostalgia is about we mourn that what we have destroyed. So here we see that Western societies become very fascinated about indigenous peoples after they have destroyed their sovereignty and reduced them to remnants that are no longer a threat, and then build the natural history museums and have the all the kind of shows and the fascination with American Indians and so forth and so on. So that leads then to the comment that Donna made about the Baptist Roman Catholic divide that began to really emerge, I think, in the late 20s, early 30s. So it's about a full generation before the land claims. But before that, of course, you had the old party, new party divide. And that came to the fore in the wake of the treaties that we have earlier discussed in the various radio shows that I did with you and with Darren. And before that, that was really primarily with Darren. We talked a lot about the treaties of 1833 in particular. And that's precisely when you begin to see the, in the wake of that, you begin to see the old party, new party divide popping up in the late 1830s. And it really sets up a dichotomy, if you will, between the traditionalists at the time and the people who were more in favor of abolishing, for example, the life chieftainship, for example, and they wanted to go to elections. So in other words, that said, the notion of division is often looked at as negative, but I realized a long time ago it is not, because what happens is, I hate to go back to the yin-yang kind of idea, but there's a dialectics for the collectivity of the community between opposition, left, right, and so forth. We see that in every democracy, we see these kind of broad coalitions that shift, but somehow the collectivity of the community begins to sail in a certain kind of direction. You may disagree with it if you're on one side as opposed to the other, but that division is actually a healthy element of democracy, and you see it actually much more prevalent than we often think if we have this kind of false notion of what a community is, that everybody is in this perpetual kumbaya moment, which it isn't, right? It's just false. I remember when I did field work in Argentina and coming myself from a village, a farming village, that there was a saying in Argentina in the village where I worked, in the Pampas, little village, big hell, which was an interesting concept, because when I heard Hillary Clinton, it talks about it takes a village. I said, do you actually know a village? I know what a village is in my community. We had sharp divisions in the community. It was a rural village, but had these differences. Finally, back to Morgan, he talked about that identity was tied to emotion. That is not unique, of course, to indigenous peoples. I was thinking about my friend who is now 91, 92, a Dutchman. When he gave up his Dutch citizenship as an immigrant, but was an emigrant from the Netherlands, he told me years later that when he was already in his 70s, that during that ceremony, when American newspapers are covering, you know, how happy all these immigrants are, he actually had a stone in his pocket and he clenched it so hard he thought he was going to crush it. The pain for him to surrender his sense of Dutchness, his Dutch ancestry, also coming from a small village, was enormous. He still talks about it today. And to finalize my comment, for the emotional reasons, no any other reason, for emotional reason alone, I have not become an American citizen, because it would have implied that I would have to give up my Dutch citizenship. And for some emotional reason, I have no benefit to it at all. Actually, it harms me repeatedly that I don't have an American passport. But the feeling that I'm no longer Dutch, I'm aware of my parents' grave right next to a 5,000-year-old megalithic site. The church is from the 13th century. Those things continue to live within me, although I've been living overseas for more than 45 years. So I know what Morgan is talking about on that level, that identity is tied to emotion, but in much more complex ways and much more universal, I think, than we often realize when we begin to talk about the indigenous experience.
Morgan?
My mind likes to wander when people say things, and it always takes like there's that joke, it's like you ever ask a Mainer for directions and they're like, they always have to say first, well, where are you coming from? Like that has anything to do with where you're going, you know, but it's kind of funny. But no, indigenous nostalgia, I hadn't thought of that. You know, I've always looked at imperialistic nostalgia, indigenous nostalgia. But no, Harold, what you got me thinking about was emotion tied to, well, obviously identity, which I'd brought up, but I got to thinking about capitalism and the way people actually, you know, use and engage with like investments and engage with like loans and all of these different things. And it's like, you know, an advisor once said, you know, he's like, for my clients, I don't, you know, I'm going to tell you, here's what you should do, right? Because you're going to buy a car for your, you have a car you want to buy, but they're giving you a loan at 1.2%, ridiculous, you know, rate, right? But then he's like, so obviously you take that because you keep the money, right? You know, and you go forward. He's like, but then there's the emotional aspect to it that he's like, I always consider. And he's like, I'll never be like, that's a stupid decision. You know, he's like, I'll always respect it because this person may want to just own the car, you know, like have it, not have it tied to anything and leave their money. So it's like, I don't know, there's a strange, my brain is trying to like circuit, you know, this like value of a thing, right? With what's right and what's not right, you know, how are we perceived by the choices we make? How are we perceived by that identity that is built not just on skin color or, you know, where we're from, what our documents say, but the decisions we make? Like it's just become, the more we talk, the more complex it gets, you know? Like we can talk about blood quantum, but without talking about it, we obviously can't talk about that wealth advisor and his how he operates with clients, right? It's like, it's everywhere. It's this web that we've, I don't know, it's just a fabric that's undeniably, I don't know if it's like how we deal with it, how we weave in and out of it. Those are my thoughts. Those are my rambling thoughts. It's just,
I think,
going back to Darren, just one kind of final thing is it's like, it's so, we can simplify it, I think, in some ways, but to simplify it is to just make it more complex, right? If we bring in the simple, then it becomes a more complex way of navigating it. I don't know. It's sort of like, it leaves me asking, it's like, well, where do we want to be, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, that's it. Like, where do we want to be? Where do we want to go, right? Yeah. And I'm not saying based off of where we are now and where we've come from, but what is it we're aiming for? What is it we're willing to sacrifice and get rid of, right? You know, it's like everybody's been to it. Well, I'm grateful for those who haven't gone to a council meeting, but like, no, I'm just kidding. But like, you know, getting everybody to agree on something is a huge ordeal, but it's like, because people don't want to abandon some things. They don't want to give up certain things. They don't want to, there's emotional aspect to it. There's objectivity, subjectivity. And it's like, all right, well, where do we want to go then? I mean, that's the question. That's the question I feel that needs answering. Where do we want to be and how do we get there collectively, you know, in a way that isn't exclusive, I suppose. Anyways, yeah. Yes.
No, I think that discussion of like an indigenous nostalgia, I've always tried to think of like, yeah, on some level, is it us buying into colonial narratives of disappearance, right? Like where we were our authentic selves at a moment right before contact. And then since then, who we are has been slowly or dramatically diminishing, right? Because we're disconnected from that original, like authentic space of being indigenous, right? And sort of, and I think that obviously feels wrong. Like we should shape our own notions of self and not be tied to, you know, a set moment in time when we were really just truly ourselves. But then, you know, we also have to deal with all this, you know, loss and harm through colonization that was taken or beaten out of us, you know. So like, you know, how do we recover those things and not kind of play into that narrative that we are no longer a true or authentic self of being Penobscot, right? That because of, you know, the language is in trouble, or the kin systems are in trouble, or whatever. So I think, you know, it's like a lot of the things, it's balancing those two pieces, right? That's why, you know, I think a lot of us are drawn to, and I think in your creative work, Morgan, you know, I think more so in your short stories than your novel, but the idea that there is this indigenous future, right? Like, what is this Penobscot future that we will fight for, you know, that we will, what we see ourselves in, as opposed to just assuming that the truest Penobscot experience was in the past somewhere, and now we're just sort of sad copies of like the original like thing. So I think like that's where, you know, for me, like that's part of the fight of determining, because you talked about what do we let go of or what do we embrace, you know, like, I mean, some of that, it just strikes me that that's part of the conversation, you know, like that would, yeah, I would want to hear in the community around, okay, like, as we reject, say, blood quantum, moving to something else, what is the future of that thing? It's not merely a rejection of, but an embrace of something else. And I think that's what feels stuck about the discussion. It's like, you know, I just don't want blood quantum to be the thing that we're like, you know, we destroy ourselves over, you know, on some level.
Well, that was going to be my next question.
Yeah. Okay, go ahead, please.
Is how do you see the future if we stay with blood quantum, or if we don't use it? What's the future? What does that look like?
Well, just to continue my thought, I'll just say, and I've expressed this before, I think there's sort of what I want, probably, and then what I think is possible. And I've said this before, I think, in these last two sessions, I think for us at Penobscot, what feels like possible is probably a shift of base role dates, and what that would include members. Because I think what will drive this discussion, just politically, realistically, you know, I mean, I have my own ideal, like, people will wake up and be like, oh, blood quantum, that's a colonial tool, we don't want to use that. Like, I don't think that's exactly possible, but what I do think is probable is you have families in our community live for generations and generations, right, in our community, who their families are starting to not be enrolled, right, and they're not citizens. So we're facing, I think, in some family cases, like, issues around heredity of owning property, which will be that I actually believe that's going to drive it. I think overall numbers of the tribal citizenry, like, we flattened out, like, we stopped going up in numbers, all right, so we're stuck around 2500, but I think it's going to be the rules of ownership and heredity, passing down property on the reservation, that is going to actually drive this discussion. And I think that's going to mean a much more slowly expansive political reality to that. But I think as we do that, I do think that that's the opportunity to have the broader discussion, meaning, like, if we changed our base role date from 1880 to 1940 or something like that, you know, that would include a bunch of people who, that would solve a heredity kind of property thing that might be happening in the next decade, but that I hope if and when we do that, that we open up the discussion in a broader term. So I think that's what I would want to see and feels realistic to me. So that's my pitch.
Morgan.
So is whether to keep blood quantum or like keep blood quantum or get rid of it, or what is that? What would those look like? I lean into Darren a little bit. I think with what Darren said, thinking, well, one, I kind of like conflict. I think that's, it's I like conflict. Well, no, let me say it this way. A professor once said, they're like to me, they're like to the whole class, they're like, I like drama on the page, not in my life. And one of the things is it's like to confront blood quantum and census is to bring conflict into everybody's life, and to bring drama into everybody's life to a degree that I wonder if people can actually handle it. If it's something that people are mentally capable of, carrying, which is why I think, Darren, you said like, within 12 years, it's like what, like what's possible, in a certain time frame. And it's like,
That's why I think, yeah, I agree with you, Morgan. It's like I feel like the conflict that will wake us into, like, will force us into it is certain families not being able to pass on property to their heirs, in because they won't be citizens, so they won't be able to own the, you know what I'm saying? Like that rule, and I don't see that rule changing. So I think with that rule in place, that's going to drive the issue of our citizenship and the blood quantum. It's going to need to shift. I guess that's sort of my sense. I'm just being realistic. Like the politics around this, really confirm a status quo until some other drama, as you put it, kind of drives it. Yeah.
No, I agree with you, and I think that's like a super important thing to note about, or at least to be like, we know it's gonna happen, right? Like it's gonna happen. Like unless somebody wakes up one day and like they change the rules, but like who is gonna do that, right? Like, but if let's say that that's the future, like that's where we're going. I think the important thing to for to not that we need to remember is that one, we knew it was coming, right? So it's like, why don't we prepare for it now? And how do we prepare for it? And two, coming back to this conflict thing, the federal government and, the Supreme Court won't hear anything about this, right? Santa Clara Pueblo versus Martinez makes that very clear, I think, when it comes to internal tribal matters, right? Their internal tribal matters, like they don't, I don't know how applicable it is. No, that was prior to Maine Indian Claim Settlement Act. So that's in with our, we have that. But I think it's to remember that coming back to this conflict is it's like the question of how we create, like going back to Harold's comment about like, a tiered kind of like membership thing. Like, how do we do something like that to perhaps alleviate, or how can we do that? And the question is whether or not, like easing people in, right? It's like, okay, you have limited benefits, but it's not about benefits. It's you have limited inherent sovereignty that will become full, sovereignty or like full belonging once we're able to manage it. But for now, we can't because of this structure we're in. Like, I think about that as like a possible way. But then it's always like, well, what would the Supreme Court say to some seeing a structure like that exist and a tribe, growing in number, but also with people who have inherent rights, not just on the reservation, right? But living on the lands we own up throughout the river. Like, it's just, I think when the time comes, it's we need to look back at this podcast. This is a time capsule podcast, or we could crack it open, at a certain point. I'm not sure, but the things we talk about now are, I don't know, are really jumbled, messy, I think, ideas and thoughts that people much smarter than us one day will be able to figure out, we're, I guess, helping, guide
So,
that next conversation.
So this conversation kind of reminds me of when we were talking about the transcripts, 1942 transcripts. You're talking about wanting to keep our population down. They don't want us expanding much, and they were afraid that 400 or 500 people from Canada would come down, and they could become members of the Penobscot Nation, and all of those people. You know what's going to happen then, and so when you look at the land claims. So this thought, this paradigm of if they expand, if they, it's sort of baked into the land claims. And it brings to mind, you remember the, forget the year, but we wanted to create a reserve other than Indian Island. I think it was up north, I think it was in Olemon, in that area. We wanted to create another reserve, and that was had to be okayed because of the articles in the land claims where the legislature had to approve it. And the argument against that, they didn't want us to do it because we really didn't want to put houses there. We wanted to put a casino there. Remember that? So when we start thinking about our future and expanding our population, expanding our numbers, expanding our territory, the system is built, and I think Morgan, you sort of mentioned that, is built to stop that in one way or another, to stop it. So, and where it, in my way of thinking is we're party to that. We're sort of like the Stockholm hostages where we've bought into that. We're not going to think outside the box here because, you know, what's going to happen to us if we do? So I just think at some point we're going to have to realize that, hey, you know, we need to have our own future. We need to figure out what we want as a future without overthinking and boxing ourselves in. And we have to fully realize the barriers that that the land claims has put there for us, for one thing. And that, you know, and a lot of this stuff has to do with what we do, what we decide, and how we move forward. So I think we have to consider all of that. I want to thank our special guests, author Morgan Talte, Professor Darren Renko, and Professor Harold Prince for being on the show today. And thank you for joining us. I'm your host, Donna Loring, and you've been listening to Wabanaki Windows. The music for our show is by Rolf Richter, a track called Little Eagles from the CD Dreamwalk. The engineers for our show are Jessica Lockhart of WMPG and Joel Mann of WERU. Tune in again next month for another Wabanaki Windows.